Chapter 2. Forth to the Wilderness. December 31, 1787. Monday. Set out from my own house, in Rutland, in the state of Massachusetts, in the service of the Ohio Company, for the mouth of the Muskingum River. Rufus Putnam. 1. Like so many born and raised on a New England farm in the 18th century, and who served in the Revolutionary War, Rufus Putnam had known hard work and hardships, great sorrow, and seemingly insurmountable obstacles most of his life. It was what was to be expected, just as one was expected to measure up. His father, a good and very useful man, had in the long family tradition pursued the occupation of a tiller of the earth in central Massachusetts. But his father died when Rufus was only 7, and when his mother remarried, it was to an illiterate tavern keeper who despised books and learning, and worse, ridiculed the boy for his ambition to learn. Because of this, Rufus was not sent to school. After I was 9 years old, I went to school in all only 3 weeks, he later wrote. To learn mathematics and spelling, he had to earn his own money to buy the school books needed. Mathematics he could handle, but spelling and grammar would remain lifelong mysteries. As he once wrote in a letter to a friend, "Had I been as much engaged in learning to write, with spelling and grammar, I might have been much better qualified to fulfill the duties of the succeeding scenes of life. Having neglected spelling and grammar when I was young, I have suffered much through life on that account." As would be said, the hardships of his early life were schoolmasters to fit him for the life in store. He had joined the army at 19, spent 3 years serving in the French and Indian War. In 1761, at 23, he was happily married to Elizabeth Ayres of Brookfield, Massachusetts. But she died in less than a year, and only months later, their infant son also died. In 1765, he married again, this time to Persis Rice of Westboro, and they were to have 9 children. His interest in, his need for, the books he was denied as a boy never left him, and one book in particular played a key part in his service during the Revolution and in the course of the war itself. This concerned General Washington's decision to try to draw the British to attack the Americans on Dorchester Heights. In the winter of 1776, Washington had put Putnam in charge of the defenses at Dorchester Heights, overlooking Boston Harbor, where the ground was frozen so hard that ordinary breastworks could not be constructed. Washington directed him to consider how this might best be accomplished and to make a report to him immediately. What followed, Putnam would describe as one of those singular circumstances which I call Providence. Coming out of the meeting, he stopped to see another of Washington's command, General William Heath, and noticed a book lying on a table, lettered on the spine, "Muller's The Field Engineer." He asked the general to let him borrow it. "He denied me," Putnam remembered. "I repeated my request. He again refused and told me he never lent his books." Putnam reminded him that it was he, General Heath, who had encouraged Putnam to undertake the role of military engineer, a role which, at the time, he had never read anything about, and that the general must let him have the book. After some more excuses on his part, and close pressing on mine, "I obtained the loan of it," Putnam wrote. Looking through the book the next morning, he saw the word chandelier, something he had never heard of before. He read what it meant, and almost immediately came up with a plan that would bring American success at Dorchester Heights and the withdrawal of the British from Boston, all from one word in a book. Putnam created his own chandeliers, heavy wooden-framed fortifications filled with fascines, bundles of sticks, that could be moved about when necessary. Washington thought so highly of him that he became the chief engineer of the army. It was Putnam who marked out most of the fortifications in Brooklyn. Later still, he rebuilt the fortifications at West Point. Since the end of the Revolution, he and his family had been living on a 155-acre farm in Rutland, at almost the precise geographical center of the Bay State. Their home, a large white-frame, hip-roof house built by a wealthy loyalist, had been confiscated at the close of the war, and so Putnam, who had by then achieved considerable success as a surveyor, was able to buy it on favorable terms. There he did much of the thinking, planning, and correspondence needed for the Ohio venture. There he drew up the first plan for the town to be built on the chosen spot at the confluence of the Muskingum and Ohio rivers. And it was there at the Putnam home on the last day of the year 1787 that at age 49 he said goodbye to his wife and family and started for the West. To what extent he foresaw the difficulties and danger that lay ahead for him and those he was to lead is hard to estimate. Most likely, it was considerable. Because he felt obliged to settle certain matters in New York concerning the Ohio Company and Indian treaties, Putnam did not catch up with his unit of westward-bound pioneers until January 24, 1788, halfway across Pennsylvania at Hummelstown on Swatara Creek, just short of Harrisburg. As they moved on, the weather turned worse. The wind-blown snow was 8 inches deep, the traveling excessive bad. In the days that followed, the going grew more difficult still. So great a quantity of snow fell that day and the following night as to quite block up the road. Our only resource now was to build sleds and harness our horses one before the other, and in this manner, with 4 sleds and the men in front to break the track, we set forward. The road, as he called it, was the Forbes Road, an old Indian trail that had been widened by the British general John Forbes for his expedition to the Forks of the Ohio during the French and Indian War, and was no easy pathway even under the best weather conditions. There were 22 in the party. Among them were 2 in particular, both Rhode Islanders, whom Putnam knew he could count on to serve in ways the others were incapable of. Most conspicuous was Ebenezer Sproat, a surveyor who at 6 feet 4 inches loomed over the rest like a giant. A highly respected officer in the war, he had afterward tried his hand at the importing trade, only to fail miserably, using all his own and his wife's resources. But by then, Congress had ordered the first surveys of the Ohio Territory under the direction of Thomas Hutchins. Sproat had been appointed the surveyor for the state of Rhode Island, and that fall joined in the operations. Though progress was limited because of Indian hostilities, he had nonetheless seen enough of the territory firsthand to know more about it than any of the others slogging west, now under the command of Rufus Putnam. In effect, Ebenezer Sproat was second in command. The other from Rhode Island, Captain Jonathan Duval, was a man of medium height whose reddish hair and strikingly clear blue eyes set him off, as did his trade. As would be said, among that body of sterling men who were bold and hardy enough to make the first settlement in the wilderness where Ohio now stands, there was no more remarkable or useful man than Captain Jonathan Duval. Having learned the skills of ship carpentry at an early age, he had become widely noted for constructing boats of a beautiful model and famed for rapid sailing. It was understood by all that building boats in the wilderness would be essential to the success of the expedition underway, as well as the success of a settlement on the Ohio River, and that would depend greatly on those relative few who knew how to do it. Others were mechanics, carpenters, and surveyors. The oldest of the party, William Moulton, a goldsmith from New Hampshire, was 67, while two others beside Jervis Cutler were still in their teens, Amos Porter from Danvers and Samuel Cushing from Hingham, Massachusetts. Between them and the promised land of Ohio now were the Allegheny Mountains, a formidable barrier. They crossed the Blue Mountain, Tuscarora Mountain, all on foot, the sleds loaded down with tools, baggage, and provisions. "Traveling both these days very bad, men and horses much fatigued," wrote Putnam. The temperature kept dropping. "The cold last night and this day may be the coldest this winter," he recorded on February 5th. At night, they slept around huge, blazing fires. To what extent whiskey served to lessen their discomforts, he did not mention, though to judge from what would be recorded on the subject in days to come, it could have been considerable. By the time they reached the westernmost of the Alleghenies, Laurel Mountain and the Chestnut Ridge, a thaw set in. Heavy rains fell, and for a full day, they could not proceed. In the days following, progress improved. Finally, on February 14th, they reached Simrel's Ferry on the Youghiogheny River, 30 miles southeast of Pittsburgh, where Hatfield White and his party were encamped. The journey for Putnam and his party over the mountains had taken nearly a month. The situation at Simrel's Ferry was not at all as wished. The same severe weather, deep snows, and bitter cold experienced by Putnam's party had greatly delayed progress. As Putnam would report to Manasseh Cutler, "No boats built, boards or planks in readiness, or person capable of building a canoe, much less a boat." Water power for the sawmill had been frozen. 5 workers had taken ill with smallpox through inoculation. Only with the recent thaw had the ice begun to melt to the point where the sawmill could operate. With the additional force of men now at hand, and Putnam in charge, a new spirit was infused into the workmen, and with Captain Duval overseeing work at the boatyard, progress on the necessary fleet moved forward steadily. It took what remained of February and all of March to build a large roofed galley, 45 feet in length and 12 feet wide, strongly timbered, and capable of carrying 50 tons. A smaller flatboat was also completed, in addition to 3 dugout canoes. And, as would be said, the burdens canoes could bear should never be underestimated. Ebenezer Sproat and several others set off with pack horses to round up the necessary provisions: flour, beans, pork, venison hams, bread, butter, and salt. By the 2nd of April, all was ready. And lest there be any doubt of their seeing their journey as an extension of their heritage, the big boat, at first called the Adventure Galley, had been renamed the Mayflower. So early that afternoon, the new Mayflower pushed off, carrying perhaps 30 men. The others, along with a large quantity of tools, tents, and provisions, packed onto the smaller galley and canoes. The whole flotilla drifted away with the current northward, some 20 miles to the point at McKeesport, where the Youghiogheny merged with a larger, muddy yellow Monongahela. From there, it was another 20 miles to where, at Pittsburgh, the Monongahela joined the clearer, faster-flowing Allegheny to form the Ohio. Even 3 miles below the junction, the waters of the Allegheny were to be distinguished from those of the Monongahela. Pittsburgh at the time, a crude frontier settlement of no more than 150 log cabins and houses, was described as an irregular, poor-built place, alongside old Fort Pitt, inhabited by a lazy set of beings, and where money affairs were at a low ebb. Its chief export was whiskey. But with its key location at the headwaters of the Ohio, Pittsburgh was the gateway to the West and almost certain to have great promise. Springtime, with the water level high, was the best of seasons to travel the river. In the heat of summer, it could dry up to half its usual size. Come winter, it could clog with ice for weeks on end. In fall, the water nearly always returned to its proper level. Still, there was no time like spring, and so in that respect, the expedition was underway just when it should have been. For 30 miles beyond Pittsburgh, the Ohio flowed not west but almost due north, past sparsely populated river settlements and the ruins of the Seneca village of Logstown, where Queen Aliquippa once held sway. Not far beyond, the river did indeed swing west until the mouth of the Beaver River, where it headed south-southwest. But then the river kept on twisting and turning. So completely serpentine was it that, in some places, as was said, a person taking observations of the sun, or stars, will find that he sometimes entirely changes his direction and appears to be going back. Islands and sandbars were past counting. As later determined, there were in fact a total of 98 islands. There were, besides, sunken trees firmly embedded in the river bottom, planters, as they were called, and sawyers, sunken trees also, but with free ends that heaved up and down with the current, as well as ordinary snags. For those on board the Mayflower, who had long looked forward to being off at last on a shimmering, sunlit voyage on the legendary Beautiful River, the disappointment could only have been great. It rained day after day, soft rain, hard rain, for hours on end. "A very disagreeable time," recorded a young surveyor with the party, John Matthews. On Saturday, April 5th, the boats tarried a full day at the mouth of Buffalo Creek to take on additional supplies and a quantity of poplar boards for building temporary huts. More heavy rain followed the next day. Nonetheless, at 8:30, with everything aboard, the expedition continued past Wheeling on the left or Virginia side of the river. Though still only a tiny backwoods settlement, Wheeling was growing steadily, in contrast to the northern side, where there was as yet not a single legal settlement. The Virginia wilderness was already thought to have a population of more than 100,000. Late in the afternoon that Sunday, the Putnam expedition tied up on the Virginia side of the Ohio River, at what was known as Round Bottom, a notable location of some 587 acres belonging to George Washington. The confluence of the Muskingum was by then 60 miles downstream, so, in order to arrive by daylight, the party rested there for 5 hours. By this point, they had traveled 140 miles on the rain-swollen Ohio, and though the celebrated charm of the river had been greatly diminished by the weather, one important welcome change to be seen in the passing landscape was the arrival of spring. Back at Simmerl's Ferry in Pittsburgh, the trees were still bare. Here they were in full green leaf. Delightsome, as said by one of the young pioneers. At 9:30, got underway, recorded John Matthews, and run all night without meeting with any accident. Overcast skies and still more rain followed the next morning, visibility not at all what would be desired for such an anticipated arrival. The flotilla drifted on past a long, narrow island, Kerr's Island, that seemed to bend with the river. And at about this point, Captain Duval remarked to General Putnam, "I think it is time to take an observation. We must be near the mouth of the Muskingum." To make matters more difficult, the riverbanks were so overgrown with giant sycamores in full leaf that the incoming Muskingum on the north side of the river was practically concealed. As a result, the party drifted on by and had to be pulled back upstream on ropes by soldiers from the garrison at Fort Harmer. At last, about 1 o'clock, Monday, April 7th, the galley tied up near the Point, as it was known, latitude 39 degrees 25 minutes north, longitude 81 degrees 20 minutes west. the pilgrims aboard their Mayflower had landed at Plymouth Rock. As long and arduous as was so much of the journey, there had been no loss of life, nor, as plainly evident, no loss of spirit. We arrived, most heartily congratulating each other on the sight of our new country, wrote one of them. The first to leap ashore, it would be said, was young Jervis Cutler, who grabbed an axe and cut down the first tree, which, as also said, was a buckeye. On hand for the arrival were some 70 native men, women, and children, led by a Delaware chief, Captain Pipe, neatly dressed in leggings and breechcloth and wearing large copper earrings. His name was not new to Rufus Putnam and the others. According to the widely known story of the torture and burning alive of Colonel William Crawford 6 years earlier, it had been Captain Pipe who painted Crawford's face black, the ceremonial sign of what was in store for him. All the natives gathered at the point seemed quite friendly. Pipe himself greeted the new arrivals as brothers. As long as the sun and moon endured, he declared, the Delawares, Wyandots, and Yankees shall be friends and brothers. Privately, Rufus Putnam thought it best to wait and see. The new arrivals went right to work, unloading the boats, making camp among the trees, and on a bit of open land by the Muskingum, putting up a large tent, the Marquee, that was to be Putnam's headquarters. They commenced with great spirit, and there is a prospect of it becoming a flourishing place in a short time, wrote an officer from Fort Harmer named Joseph Buell. To General Josiah Harmer, it was already obvious these were quite a different set of people from the usual frontiersmen. Only days later, Ebenezer Sproat and John Matthews, with their surveyors, chains, and compasses, and a crew of 13, set out to survey 8-acre lots Rufus Putnam had planned along what were known as the Bottomlands by the Ohio and the Muskingum. Each settler was to be given both a small in-lot within the town for a place of residence and an out-lot of 8 acres on which to grow crops. With his commanding height, Sproat had caught the attention of the local Indians almost from the moment he stepped ashore, and was given the name Old Hetuck, Big Buckeye. 6,000 acres were set apart for what in all-out optimism was called a new city. Rufus Putnam had overall charge of the survey and all elements of the plan, residential lots, straight streets, and public squares, all as in a compact New England town. Indeed, it was and would remain his foremost intention to create a new New England in the wilderness. The main streets were to conform to the course of the Muskingum and extend upstream a little more than a mile. They were to be 90 feet wide and crossed at right angles by others 70 feet wide. The main streets were designated by numbers, the cross streets by the names of officers of the American Revolution. One of these cross streets, a little north of the center of the plot, would be 120 feet wide, the widest, grandest of them all, and named Washington. The overriding immediate tasks were clearing land and building shelter. Though accustomed as most were to hard work, few had had any experience in clearing virgin forests. Sometimes it took one man 3 to 4 weeks to chop down a single acre of hard wooded forest, leaving the stumps in the ground. When it came to the largest of the trees, they had to be girdled, a ring of bark cut away around the trunk so that the sap could not rise, and thus the tree would stand in place and slowly die. Many of the giant surviving stumps were to last for decades. Huge accumulating log heaps demanded weeks of laborious attention, unless the weather remained dry, which it seldom did. To keep them from rotting, The logs required constant rolling together and repiling, heavy, dirty work. But persist, the settlers did. In the words of an old Ohio Valley poem, "The axe in stalwart hands, with steadfast stroke, the savage echoes of the forest woke. And one by one, breaking the world-old spell, the hardy trees, long crashing, with thunder, fell." The site chosen for the settlement was an elevated plateau 3/4 of a mile back from the Ohio, on the eastern side of the Muskingum. Fort Harmer, its flags flying, stood prominently on a cleared bluff downstream on the opposite or western side of the Muskingum, at the confluence with the Ohio. The fort had been built 3 years before, in 1785, on the orders of Josiah Harmer, not as protection against the native tribes, but to protect them from the encroachment of illegal settlers, or squatters, on government land, crossing into Ohio from western Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Kentucky. Many of these were of Scotch-Irish descent, and, as said, not strongly attached to government, either of the royal or proprietary kind. Another characteristic was their intense hatred of the Indians, for whose treatment the extermination policy was generally considered to be the proper model. To move into the Ohio wilderness, the squatters had only to cross the Ohio River. Of the two rivers, the Ohio and the Muskingum, the Ohio was much the larger, measuring about 400 yards from shore to shore in springtime. The natives called it OEO, Great River. The Muskingum was roughly 200 yards across, but clearer and smoother flowing. Muskingum, in the native tongue, meant elk's eye. The waters of both rivers teemed with catfish weighing from 3 to as much as 80 pounds, buffalo fish from 5 to 30 pounds, sturgeon and pike, and at the confluence of the rivers especially, the fishing was ideal, all to the particular delight of the New Englanders. Wild turkeys and passenger pigeons were in unimaginable abundance. White-tailed deer, otter, elk, buffalo, beaver, wolves, and bear filled the forests in all directions. So plentiful were squirrels that hardly a day passed without a few hundred being killed. From the site of the new settlement, the view, wherever visible through the trees, took in both rivers for at least 3 miles. In a letter to Manasseh Cutler, Rufus Putnam, never one to exaggerate, wrote that as a site for a future city, it was the most beautiful he had ever seen. But the measureless forest, the gigantic trees of every kind, hickory, beech, sycamore, tulip, ash, buckeye, oaks 6 feet in diameter that reached 50 feet before breaking out in branches, were the dominating reality. Of all these, it was the sycamore that seemed, in the words of one observer, the king of the forest. Their monstrous growth, towering height, and extended branches really fill the beholder with awe. And it was the immense task of clearing portions of open space that went on every day but Sunday, men working with persevering industry. Teamwork counted greatly in clearing land, as it did in facing almost every challenge to be met on the frontier. At times, there could be as many as 6 axes chopping away in unison to bring down one single giant of the forest. Trees were the enemy, standing in the way of progress. But clearly, too, in their immense size and variety, they spoke of rich, productive soil and could provide no end of firewood and logs for cabins and storage sheds. Yellow poplar was especially good for heavy planking. The buckeye was a favorite for making bowls, chairs, and cradles. Further, Rufus Putnam insisted, a new stockade for defense of the settlement had to be built without delay. However friendly had been the welcome given by Captain Pipe and his people, Putnam had reason to be cautious. During his time in New York on the route west, going over former treaties made with the native tribes, he had become quite concerned. I was fully persuaded that the Indians would not be peaceable very long, hence the propriety of immediately erecting a cover for the immigrants who were soon expected. Fort Harmer, across the way, was a log pentagon that enclosed within its walls about 3/4 of an acre. Whatever sense of security it provided as protection against the Indians would hardly be enough as the settlement grew. This, that Putnam planned, was to be considerably larger and more substantial, capable of being a safe refuge for the whole settlement should there be an attack. Besides, the soldiers at Fort Harmer were not known for high standards of conduct. Drunkenness and desertion were prevalent evils, as Joseph Buell, one of the officers, recorded. The treatment of the soldiers was excessively severe, and that flogging the men to the extent of 100 lashes was an almost daily occurrence. They seemed to have been selected from the most worthless and depraved remnants of the revolutionary soldiers, men too lazy and idle to engage in any laborious employments. And as their wages were only $3 a month, no sober, industrious man would engage in the service. As everyone knew, few were better prepared to design and build a fortification than General Putnam, and the facility he created now in the wilderness was extraordinary, in that it went up in so little time, given all else that had to be done, and would serve so effectively as the bulwark of the settlement. Located half a mile up the Muskingum from the point, it was to be a great square structure with outer walls 188 feet in length, and would have, when completed, strong blockhouses at all four corners, each surrounded by a watchtower, and walls of yellow poplar planks 4 inches thick, and 36 residences. In all, it was designed to house 864 people. The front faced toward the Muskingum, and in the center of the open court, a well was dug to a depth of 80 feet, no small task in itself. Jonathan Duvall was to supply the timber for the corner blockhouses. It was called Campus Martius, Latin for Field of Mars, and referred to as a stockade, not a fort. In addition, a good-sized timber wharf was erected on the Muskingum, opposite Fort Harmer, at which were moored the Mayflower, canoes, and a fine new cedar barge for 12 oarsmen for General Putnam, this too built by Jonathan Duvall. A substantial bridge went up over the creek, Tiber Creek, that flowed into the Muskingum in the southern part of the settlement. The bridge was fully 25 feet high, 90 feet long, 24 feet wide, and covered with hewn planks 4 inches thick. It was the first bridge to be built in the Northwest Territory and was to stand for decades. The whole while, dozens of cabins, large and small, and crude huts, or worse, were going up, so great was the need for shelter. One young man chose to spend the better part of a year quartered in the hollow trunk of an ancient tree. Jervis Cutler and another young pioneer, John Gardner, the son of a sea captain from Marblehead, Massachusetts, were clearing land together and making good progress. Gardner had come west, as did many others, in search of fortune and adventure. Then, one morning, when Jervis was absent, as he sat resting on a tree stump, he was suddenly seized by a party of Shawnees, who hurried him into the woods where their horses were hidden. There they all mounted but one, who walked and led the prisoner by a rope around his neck. That night, with his hands tied behind his back, he was bound to the trunk of a sapling that had been bent to the ground. After the weary march of the second day, his captors, feeling they were beyond the fear of pursuit, eased up somewhat, shot a bear and a deer, roasted both over a fire, and offered him a plentiful repast. They also tried to persuade him to join them, painted his face, cut off part of his hair, promised to make him a good Shawnee, even provide a Shawnee wife. Still, they secured him as before. That night, a light rain fell, making the thongs that bound him more pliable. By cautious and continued effort over several hours, he succeeded in releasing himself and slipped away into the dark forest. Walking all night and the following day, in what he sensed was the direction of home, he slept the next night in a hollow log, then continued on the day after until finally he reached home, there to be joyfully welcomed. Though it is said that the next morning he and Jervis returned to their land clearing with renewed spirit, it is also true that John Gardner would soon depart for Marblehead and life at sea on his father's ship, doubtless preferring to encounter the ills he knew than those he knew not of.
On an elevated plain, just to the north of Campus Martius, was a prominent, mysterious, and much-talked-about feature of the landscape that defied ready explanation, except that it was the work of some ancient, vanished people. Spread across more than 90 acres was a variety of earthworks in direct lines, in squares and elevated mounds, including one dominant conical burial mound 30 feet high. Rufus Putnam, who made careful maps of the area, called the entire system of earthworks the Ancient Works. The conical mound was known as the Great Mound. Accounts of such earthworks were already exciting Eastern scholars. Ezra Stiles, the president of Yale, thought they proved the descent of the Indians from the Canaanites, expelled from Palestine by Joshua. Benjamin Franklin speculated such mounds might have been constructed by Hernando de Soto in his wanderings. 3 years earlier, in the winter of 1785, during his travels along the Ohio Valley, General Samuel Parsons had written to Ezra Stiles about what he took to be the remains of an ancient fortification at the mouth of the Muskingum, and that the size of the trees growing on top left little doubt that it had been abandoned long before America was discovered by Europeans. Not only was there a giant white oak, more than 3 feet in diameter, on top of the conical mound, but it appeared to have sprung from the remains of an earlier tree in the same place. So fascinated was Stiles with what Parsons had to report that he passed the letter on to Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson, who was long fascinated by Indian lore, was intensely interested in the mounds, but remained open-minded. "It is too early to form theories on those antiquities," he wrote. "We must wait with patience till more facts are collected." Rufus Putnam, who had studied every feature of the site, found those works so perfect as to put it beyond all doubt that they are the remains of a work erected at an amazing expense perhaps some 1,000 years since, by a people who had very considerable knowledge of fortifications. They were, besides, he decided, people of ingenuity, industry, and elegance. He was in awe of the achievements of these ancient builders, noting that the gradual ascent to the tops of the two largest mounds, Quadrinau and Capitolium, as they were called by the newcomers, were like a beautiful flight of steps in the yard of the governor's house in Massachusetts. Nor was the gravel walk of the Boston Mall more regular than what was called the Covered Way, a walkway that he had measured to be 231 feet wide, which led from the Muskingum to the Great Mound, Quadrinau, and was framed by parallel earthen walls rising some 26 feet. What Putnam and the others did not know at the time was that the ancient ruins were as old as the ruins of Rome. As later archaeologists would determine, the whole complex was the work of what was known as the Ohio Hopewell culture, and that the Great Mound was built between 100 BC, when the Hopewell began to occupy southern Ohio, and AD 500, making it more than 2,000 years old. At home in New England, concern over the fate of the pioneers grew steadily. There had been little at all in the way of communication. Only rumors were plentiful, and fearsome more often than not, and ever-increasing worries among families and friends. Manasseh Cutler had not had a word from Rufus Putnam, nor from Jervis, since they set off for the Ohio country. "It has been currently reported here," Cutler wrote to Putnam on April 21st, "that you and your whole party were cut off, going down the river by the Indians, and not one escaped to tell the doleful tale. Terrible stories are spread respecting the hostility and number of the Indians. Wish we may be favored with an account of the matter from you." Nearly a month later, there was still no word. "Have not received a line from you since you left New England," Cutler wrote again to Putnam on May 15th. All the same, Cutler assured him, the spark for emigration to the Western country had kindled into a blaze, and numbers of families were preparing for the exodus. In a long letter dated May 16, 1788, that did get through to a friend back in Massachusetts named Isaiah Thomas, a publisher, Putnam gave a full description of the state of affairs there on the Ohio, and with the understanding that the letter could be published, which it was, in the popular paper called The Massachusetts Spy. "All was going as hoped," Putnam wrote. "That part of the purchase I have been over far exceeds my expectations. He had never seen soil so rich, trees of such size or so numerous. He described the views, the water supply, the favorable climate. He reported, too, that in laying out our city, we have preserved some of the ancient works from becoming private property, by including them within lots or squares appropriated to public uses." It was a decision that can be rightly seen as a pioneering step in historic preservation. Finally, concerning the natives, Putnam could say only that a treaty was being planned. He had met with Captain Pipe and told him he and other settlers hoped they could all live in friendship and that they would be glad to see them at all times. However, in a letter to Manasseh Cutler written the same day, Putnam did not rule out the possibility of an Indian attack. "At present, we do not think ourselves perfectly secure from them." Yes, the Delawares and Wyandots appeared very friendly, but he judged the Mingos, Shawnees, and Cherokees residing by the waters of the Scioto to be a set of thievish, murdering rascals. Another letter that appeared back east at about the same time, this by an unidentified settler, expressed utmost wonder and joy as though the promised land had indeed been reached at last. "This country, for fertility of soil and pleasantness of situation, not only exceeds my expectations, but exceeds any part of America or Europe I ever was in. The climate is exceedingly healthy, not a man sick since we have been here. We have startled 20 buffaloes in a drove. Deer are as plenty as sheep are with you. Beaver and otter are abundant. I have known one man to catch 20 or 30 of them in 2 or 3 nights. Turkeys are innumerable. They come within a few rods of us in the fields. We have already planted a field of 150 acres in corn." Every now and then, back home, an occasional expression of doubt would appear concerning the mania for Ohio immigration, as in a letter published that spring in the Massachusetts Gazette. "The delusive tales that have been told concerning the fertility of the Western country have infatuated many of our citizens to such a degree that some of them have been led to harbor the idea that all the luxuries of life are to be had there in greatest abundance, without money and without price, and that with very little labor the fruits of the earth will yield most spontaneously. Inhabitants of Massachusetts, Be not led away by such fairy tales. Imbibe not such chimerical notions. Ever since our first parents were banished from the Garden of Eden, and God cursed the ground for Adam's sin, it is a fixed decree that man shall earn his bread by the sweat of the brow. Ohio or no Ohio, this is a serious truth. Stay at home, fellow citizens, and till your farms. Be industrious, and your labors will be crowned with success. Be not dupes to Ohio quixotism. But Ohio fever was by no means limited to Massachusetts or even New England. As strong as any endorsements were those from George Washington. No colony in America was ever settled under such favorable auspices as that which has just commenced at Muskingum, he wrote in one letter. I know many of the settlers, personally, and there never were men better calculated to promote the welfare of such a community. To the Marquis de Lafayette, he wrote, A spirit of immigration to the Western country is very predominant. Many of your military acquaintances, such as Generals Parsons, Varnum, and Putnam, Colonels Tupper, Sproat, with many more, propose settling there. From such beginnings, much may be expected. New settlers kept arriving. Dr. Jabez True was the first physician to land at the point. Paul Fearing, the first attorney. Both were still in their 20s. Another young man, James Backus from Connecticut, was notable for his affluence, as made evident by the extensive quantity of clothing and other necessities he had brought along for his venture into the woods. 3 shirts, 2 pair worsted stockings, 1 pair check trousers, 1 pair leather breeches, 1 pair Indian stockings, 1 pair shoes, 1 pair moccasins, 26 sheets of paper of fine quality, vial of ink, 1 case of instruments, 1 waistcoat, 1 silk handkerchief, 2 hatchets, 1 tomahawk, 2 Indian blankets, 10 gallons whiskey, 1 red cedar box containing a needle, a small file, a leather wrapper with thread, and needles. During his first year in the new settlement, he was to spend most of his time building a frame house and socializing at teas and dinners with friends. Mary Owen, the first woman to join the settlement, arrived with her husband, James Owen. She was a nurse accompanying one of the directors of the Ohio Company, General James Varnum, who was suffering from a lung complaint. Samuel Parsons, too, came down the Ohio on a barge carrying Josiah Harmer, Winthrop Sargent, and some 25 others, pretty close crowded, on board, along with 2 cows, 2 calves, 7 hogs, 9 dogs, in addition to 8 tons of baggage. More followed week after week to the point that the adventurers on the scene numbered nearly 100, and still more were expected. Every prospect as to the goodness of our lands and the facility of producing the means of living equal my most sanguine hopes, reported Samuel Parsons to his wife back in Connecticut. He planned to begin work on a house the next day. The land was as good as to be found anywhere in the universe, asserted another of those who arrived on the same barge with Parsons. He was John May of Boston, and soon clearing land and, as a man of means, had a crew working with him. All hands clearing land. All busy. Still clearing land, he wrote repeatedly in his diary. From the moment he had stepped ashore, John May appears to have taken heart from nearly everything he saw. The location answers the best description I have ever heard of it. The situation delightfully agreeable, well calculated for an elegant city. He was charmed by the mound and, like so many, amazed by the abundance and variety of food to be had. I dare say not a market in the world can produce a greater plenty than we shall have this fall. At the end of May, a young Army officer named Ebenezer Denny, newly assigned to Fort Harmer, wrote in his diary with much admiration about the newly established pioneers and how much they had accomplished in only 2 months' time. These men from New England, many of whom were of the first respectability, old Revolutionary officers, had erected and were now living in huts immediately opposite us. A considerable number of industrious farmers had purchased shares in the Ohio Company and more or less arrive every week. A spacious city is laid out here. About half a mile up the Muskingum, upon very commanding ground, the site of a very ancient and very extraordinary fortification was erected a place of arms and security called Campus Martius. Building put up of hewn timber, 2 stories high, forming an oblong square with strong blockhouses in each angle, leaving a considerable area within. Here their stores, etc., were lodged, and some families, perhaps more timid than others, reside. But generally, both men and women appear enterprising. "Those people," he further wrote, "appear the most happy folks in the world, greatly satisfied with their new purchase. But they certainly are the best informed, most courteous and civil to strangers of any people I have yet met with." But as the weeks passed, John May, like numbers of others, began discovering not all was perfection in the promised land by the Ohio. Myriads of gnats were eating him alive. Not only did they bite surprisingly, but got down one's throat. After 8 backbreaking days clearing land, he was inflamed with poison ivy. Thunder and lightning all night. Little sleep for me. Worst of all, his dog was shot at and injured so severely by a young settler that May had him killed and buried. I tried to catch the fellow, but he ran too nimble for me. At night came the howling of wolves and caterwauling of panthers in the forests. Night and day there was the pungent, almost ceaseless smell of smoke in the air from the fires that were kept going in the clearings, burning up giant heaps of brush and tree limbs. One night, Captain Pipe and the Delawares had hellish powwows across the Muskingum that went on well into the morning. Tired as he was, John May could not get to sleep. "I have no doubt in my mind that psalmody had its origin in heaven," he wrote, "and my faith is as strong that the music of these savages was first taught in hell." Word came from the Virginia side of the Ohio that the settlement was about to be attacked by 3 strong parties of Chippewas, but that proved false. "At Boston," observed May, "we are alarmed with fires and inundations. Here the Indians answer the same purpose. Wherever we go, we must expect to meet with trouble." Even before the onset of summer, several of the pioneers had had enough. A number of poor devils, 5 in all, took their departure homeward this morning, wrote May on June 15th. "They came from home brainless and moneyless, and have returned the same, though not without my blessing in full." The weather turned hot. The Ohio was running low, sluggishly. All the same, the Muskingum trips on as nimble, as sprightly as a miss in her teens, May wrote. Early one Sunday morning, he plunged into the Muskingum for the first time. "It looked so tempting I could not refrain, and felt myself much refreshed." On July 2nd, Ohio Company directors and agents gathered in General Putnam's tent for the first such meeting held west of the Allegheny Mountains, and passed a resolution officially naming the settlement. Skeptics back in Massachusetts had begun calling it Putnam's Paradise. Manasseh Cutler had suggested it be named Adelphia for Brotherhood. Those on the scene had been calling it Muskingum. Now it was officially to become Marietta, in tribute to Queen Marie Antoinette of France, who, the former officers in the Continental Army felt, had done more than anyone, including Benjamin Franklin, to persuade the King of France to lend support to the American cause with both financial and military help. As was said about the decision on the name, it was a natural gush of feeling in the hearts of these old officers to remember with gratitude their kind benefactress and to perpetuate her name by connecting it with their infant city. As for the name of the surrounding county, there seems to have been no need for discussion. It would be Washington County. Despite periodic showers, the infant city's first celebration of July 4th took place under a 60-foot-long green bower built for the occasion beside the Muskingum. Some 150 people attended. Judge Joseph Varnum delivered a most flowery oration in which he complimented those gathered for their courage to explore the paradise of America, and declared, "Hope no longer flutters upon the wings of uncertainty." Then followed a spread of food and drink in ample quantity, wild meat, turkeys and other wild fowl, and a variety of fish, including, as none present would forget, a giant 100-pound pike caught just downstream at the mouth of the Muskingum. A seemingly limitless supply of punch and wine was at hand, and patriotic toasts were raised one after another to the United States, to Congress, the King of France, the new federal constitution, Captain Pipe, the wives at home back east, 13 toasts in all. "Pleased with our entertainment," recorded John May, "we did not separate till 12 o'clock." The next morning, he was up at 5 and, like everyone else, back at work. On July 9th, General Arthur St. Clair, who had been president of the Congress at the time of the passage of the Northwest Ordinance, arrived at Fort Harmer to a national salute of 13 guns, one for each state. And on July 15th, on the other side of the Muskingum, in the same green bower where the 4th of July celebration was held, St. Clair, with appropriate ceremony, became the first governor of the Northwest Territory, and thus civil government was now officially established. While serving as the President of Congress, St. Clair had shown only lukewarm interest in the Northwest Territory, but as would later be written, a change came over him when it was proposed to make him governor of the territory, and his warmest interest and endeavors were enlisted. 2. In mid-August, the Reverend Manasseh Cutler appeared on the scene, having traveled the full distance from Ipswich Hamlet, 751 miles, in just 29 days, a new record. Expecting to be absent from home and his pastoral duties for at least 3 months, he had relinquished his salary before setting off. He had traveled as far as the Allegheny Mountains, riding in a high-wheeled sulky, then by horseback over the mountains, then by barge down the Ohio. There had been rain and fog aplenty, excessively bad roads, steep, anxious ascents and descents, and barely tolerable roadside taverns. But it was summer the whole way, nothing like what Rufus Putnam and his party had experienced. On his voyage down the very romantic Ohio, Cutler had the pleasure of the company of General Benjamin Tupper, his wife, their 5 children, and 2 grandchildren, as well as 4 other families, making 36 migrants heading for Marietta, including 14 children. They were the first group of families to arrive at the settlement, and the fathers were all veterans of the Revolution, men whose experience, as they knew, had prepared them for the tasks ahead in a way nothing else could have. As another notable veteran, Joseph Barker, who was to follow later, would write, they had had a second education in the Army of the Revolution, where they heard the precept of wisdom and saw the example of bravery and fortitude. They had been disciplined to obey and learn the advantage of subordination to law and good order in promoting the prosperity and happiness of themselves and the rest of mankind. At the point, a good crowd had gathered, people cheering, dogs barking. Rufus Putnam, Samuel Parsons, and Winthrop Sargent were among the welcoming committee. Not to be seen among the crowd, however, was Jervis Cutler, whose adventurous spirit, as his father already knew, had propelled him elsewhere for the time being. First reactions by the newcomers to the realities of what was to be their new home in Campus Martius were mostly favorable, as one of the Tupper daughters would write. "Our buildings are decent and comfortable. The Indians appear to be perfectly friendly," she said, adding notwithstanding, "there is a guard placed every night." In his usual energetic fashion, Manasseh Cutler was bent on seeing as much as possible and enjoying to the full the hospitality provided and the encouraging progress to be seen. Cabin raisings were taking place, joint efforts by neighbors to provide the newcomers places to live, and with many working together, a cabin could go up in remarkably little time. The customary pay provided for such efforts was whiskey, in generous quantity. With Rufus Putnam, Cutler walked the city lots and a cornfield the size of which astonished him, as did corn already grown to an unimaginable 14 feet high. One tulip tree, nearly 6 feet in diameter, he estimated to be over 400 years old. Not surprisingly, it was the trees that commanded Cutler's greatest attention. He could be seen studying and measuring the stumps of those that had been cut down, carefully counting the circles. One sycamore, or buttonwood, measured 21 feet in circumference. On the stump of one elm, he counted 336 well-defined circles. With Generals Parsons and Varnum, he inspected what was known as the Great Tree, a giant hollow black walnut just back from the Muskingum River. At 2 feet above ground, the tree measured 41 feet in circumference. Six men on horseback could parade inside it at the same time, Cutler was told. As always, he took time to record every day's activities with particular attention to the natural wonders to be seen. One day, he carefully dissected a poisonous copperhead snake. Took off his head and examined his teeth, took out 7 teeth from the bladder on one side of his jaw, found a circular bone in which the teeth were inserted. This bone is connected with the jaw by a strong ligament. Sudden and heavy rains, by which he was almost drowned, mist, fog, along with abounding mud, appear to have characterized a greater part of his visit. In compensation, the women he met all struck him as bright and charming. Miss Anna Sims was a very well-accomplished young lady. She would one day become the wife of President William Henry Harrison. Mrs. Harmer, the general's wife, was a fine woman, and at a dinner given by Captain William McCurdy featuring squirrel pie, he found Mrs. McCurdy very agreeable. As might have been expected, Cutler was utterly fascinated by the mound and loved conversing with others at length on the subject. In the middle of one night, he was called on to visit the seriously ill child of one of the couples with whom he had traveled down the Ohio. But by the time he arrived, the child, 13-month-old Nabby Cushing, had died. Hers was the first death among the settlers of Marietta. The parents had 6 remaining children with them, and the mother was expecting another later in the winter. The conspicuous presence of the natives of different tribes in the daily life of the community pleased Cutler no end. "We have had Indians to dine with us almost every day, principally Delawares, Wyandots, one or two Shawnees, Mingos, Seneca, or 6 Nations. No other nations come in." The Chippewas and Ottawas, he was told, appeared to be inclined for war. At one point he did complain that when he returned to his quarters at night, he found numerous Indians standing about, the squaws mostly drunk. On Sunday, August 24th, the Reverend Cutler preached a powerful sermon before a large gathering at Campus Martius. He spoke at length, clearly having given it much thought. God and gospel figured prominently. So also did religious freedom and learning and the new nation at hand. It may be emphatically said that a new empire has sprung into existence, and that there is a new thing under the sun. By the Constitution now established in the United States, religious as well as civil liberty is secured. Some serious Christians may possibly tremble for the Ark and think the Christian religion in danger when divested of the patronage of civil power. They may fear inroads from licentiousness and infidelity on the one hand, and from sectaries and party divisions on the other. But we may dismiss our fears when we consider that truth can never be in real hazard, where there is a sufficiency of light and knowledge and full liberty to vindicate it. He was patriotic, high-minded, unmistakably brimming with pride and confidence in the community underway and its values, and optimistic about the future. Such is the present state of things in this country, that we have just ground to hope that religion and learning, the useful and ornamental branches of science, will meet with encouragement, and that they will be extended to the remotest parts of the American empire. Here we behold a country vast in extent, mild in its climate, exuberant in its soil, and favorable to the enjoyment of life. Here may the gospel be preached to the latest period of time, the arts and sciences be planted, the seeds of virtue, happiness, and glory be firmly rooted and grow up to full maturity. Traffic on the river grew steadily, with by far the greater part of it heading farther downstream to Virginia and Kentucky. The Kentucky-bound boats numbered 10 or 12 a day. It was said that before the year was out, more than 900 boats carrying more than 18,000 people had passed by the New England settlement, as Marietta was sometimes called. The variety in the shapes and sizes of the means of transportation on the river was a spectacle in itself. Flatboats, rafts, barges of all sizes, and keelboats. The flatboat was a heavy, flat-bottomed rectangular box, 8 to 10 feet wide and 30 or 40 feet long. It would be described a mixture of log cabin, fort, floating barnyard, and country grocery, and was how the vast majority of the floating pilgrims traveled. John James Audubon, who embarked on the Ohio on his wedding journey, described passengers huddled together with their animals and poultry. The roof or deck of the boat was not unlike a farmyard, being covered with hay, plows, carts, wagons, and spinning wheels of the matrons were conspicuous. Even the sides of the floating mass were loaded with the wheels of the different vehicles which themselves lay on the roof. At the end of their journey, the flatboats would be broken apart, the lumber used for a variety of purposes. The keelboat, on the other hand, was intended for travel both downstream and back up against the current. The keelboat, as said, heralded a new era. It was a long, narrow craft, from 50 to 70 feet in length, and had a 15 to 18 foot beam, shallow draft, was pointed at both prow and stern, and had a narrow running board from prow to stern on either side. The crew consisted of many men, a number of whom on the running boards, using long poles, would walk from bow to stern, pushing the boat upstream, or if not that, they would pull on oars. Under certain circumstances, it made sense to grab hold of the bushes and trees on the river's banks and pull the boat forward upstream. This was known as bushwhacking. There was no more grueling work in the New West than that of the keelboatman. and they were to become a long-standing, colorful element of life on the river, a distinct class, with their red flannel shirts and wool hats set off with a feather. More often than not, seasoned keelboat hands also carried one or two signs of their way of life after hours, a damaged nose or ear or face scars, of which they were quite proud. As one Ohio River historian was to write in understatement, if a town had a really malodorous repute, it was to them, then, an excellent place to lie over and relax a bit. Their relaxing, of course, did nothing to quiet the scene of their repose. On September 9th, after a stay of 3 weeks, Manasseh Cutler started for home back up the Ohio. It was a sparkling clear day, and he was on a fine large keelboat with 10 boatmen pulling on oars. It was a boat belonging to a merchant from Pittsburgh returning from a trip to New Orleans, who invited Cutler to be his guest. No sooner had they left shore than around Kerr's Island came a barge carrying more than 50 soldiers from Fort Pitt and some 40 Indians in canoes lashed together. The soldiers were standing ramrod straight in immaculate uniforms, and the Indians were in full dress. Among them was the celebrated Corn Planter, chief of the Senecas. The Indians, on their way to a treaty gathering, were carrying two small American flags. It was a spectacle Cutler was never to forget. Plans were changed temporarily. Cutler's boat turned back to stop at Fort Harmer for several hours, during which Cutler had the chance to talk with Corn Planter. The chief was in his 80s, the son of a white Indian trader and a Seneca woman, and known as a strong leader and great orator. Cutler, as he later wrote, was surprised to see a man of that age with so much sprightliness about him, his body erect and countenance rather florid, and yet marks of senility were more evident on his body than in his mind. When Cutler asked Corn Planter about the origins of the mound, Corn Planter said he did not know who made them, nor for what purpose. It was a mystery. At about mid-afternoon, Cutler's journey upriver resumed. Any desire, such as he had earlier expressed, of becoming part of the settlement, appears to have subsided. How soon he might return to Marietta for another visit, or possibly even to stay, was impossible to predict, given all he had to attend to at home. With the passage of autumn and the days growing shorter, the work to be done was greater still. Winter was coming, winter in the wilderness, and much needed seeing to. Darkness fell earlier, but with the leaves gone from the trees, the stars and moon blazed in the night sky. In mid-December, some 200 members of different native tribes marched down the western shore of the Muskingum to Fort Harmer, a great number on horseback, and those out front carrying the flag of the United States. As they approached the fort, they fired their rifles as a sign of friendship, and the salute was returned by several minutes of cannon and rifle fire from the fort. A guard of soldiers, with music, then escorted them into the garrison. Thus commenced the procedures of a new treaty. The Delawares, Wyandots, and Ottawas had formed a loose confederacy. They had come in earnest, and all spirituous liquors were prohibited on both sides. But the most important members of the confederacy, the Shawnees and the Miamis, had refused to attend the council. The leaders of the confederacy wanted rescinding of the cessions north of the Ohio River. The American government hoped that by a modest payment for the cessions, settlement could continue north of the Ohio without violence. As the days passed, the Indians were slaughtering great quantities of game for their own subsistence. But as the chances of their getting what they wanted from the treaty seemed increasingly unlikely, They began killing all the game they could within a radius of 20 miles or more. Rarely could a deer now be seen where before a good hunter could kill from 10 to 15 a day. A settler later wrote that the natives said they meant to kill all the game and thus destroy and starve out every white face north of the Ohio. Captain Pipe and others of the tribes had become alarmed by the size of what was being built by the settlers and the numbers that kept arriving. The native people did not believe land was something to be owned. In the words of a Wyandot named Turk, "No one in particular can justly claim this land. It belongs in common to us all. No earthly being has an exclusive right to it. The Great Spirit above is the true and only owner of this soil, and he has given us all an equal right to it." The treaty that was finally signed on January 9, 1789, would bring little change for the better. It was, as said, an insincere and hollow affair. Rufus Putnam, who had kept closer watch than anyone on all that went on, wrote, "This treaty, under all circumstances, gave us no real security, or reason to relax in our precautions against a surprise." The day following, on January 10th, General Varnum, who had been suffering with consumption from the time of his arrival and had grown quite feeble, died at age 40. From the start, he had taken his responsibilities at Marietta quite seriously and, much to his credit, played an active part in promoting a resolution for the preservation of the ancient ruins of the mound. But with the advance of his illness, he had become a very unhappy man and proved increasingly hard to deal with, taking issue with Rufus Putnam's land distribution policies and making life difficult for others. To Manasseh Cutler, who confessed that Varnum had given him much uneasiness, it was as if his death had been an intervention of divine providence. Meanwhile, two notable advances had been made in the life of the settlement. A first school was established in one of the blockhouses at Campus Martius, and a first general store opened on the point, the enterprise of the affluent young James Backus from Connecticut, in partnership with another young man from Connecticut, Dudley Woodbridge. In their inventory of stock at hand, the first thing listed was 57 gallons of whiskey. As the year's end approached, the population of Marietta numbered 132 people, including 15 families, and it may be said nearly all were still optimistic. Winter set in cold in mid-December. One cold day after another was followed by very cold days, or still very cold days. The Ohio River became choked with ice, to the point that no boats moved up or downstream, and the settlers, who had so recently enjoyed such a wondrous abundance of food, now found themselves hard-pressed for enough to eat. Jediah Bagley was an itinerant fiddler who moved about among the settlements playing for parties, weddings, and funerals. Trudging through the snow along the Muskingum one freezing afternoon, he was chased by wolves and just barely succeeded in climbing a willow on the riverbank. Gripping the tree with his legs, he managed to get the fiddle off his back and out of its case and began to play for the wolves on into the night, until they finally saw fit to leave him. The next morning, it was said, he continued on through the snow playing one tune after another, until at last he reached Marietta. True or not, the story would help a great many get through much that was to come.